Making a living from a small herd of cows while allowing nature to flourish is the goal of Sinead Moran and her partner Mick. In this podcast, she tells us how she runs her dairy farm and why she puts such importance on farming alongside nature. This is Ground Tips, a podcast from Farming for Nature, which brings you the best advice from Irish farmers to help you restore life back to the land. I'm Bridget Barry. Sinead, thanks a million for joining us today. You're a dairy farmer on about 27 acres in County Mayo, where you sell raw organic milk. Perhaps you can just start with setting the scene for us. Can you set the scene of the farm for us, for those of us who haven't been there?
If you come at the height of summer and if you come and spend time with the cows, then you'll come and you'll bring them in the morning. It's a pretty chilled out milking scenario. We milked 12 last year. We'll be milking 14 this year. So they're never too far away. It's 17 acres around the parlor. So they're just in around there. So the furthest you'll have to walk is a few hundred meters up a tree lined path. You call the girls, they'll come to the walkway because we move them every day, so they're well used to it. They'll walk in ahead of you, they'll do the rest themselves. They come down into the parlor because the last couple of years we were using a mobile milker, so we milk them in pairs. So they kind of stand into their pairs. The first two always must go first. We'll queue up first. The next two, the second, or technically the fourth cow, she can open the gate, so she'd open the gate for herself. So they just kind of do as they wish. They come in, they're milked. We are pretty chilled in the parlor, and we like to play music as well. It keeps them nice and chilled because we milk once a day and we milk the same time every day. They're normally in there ready to be ruminating, so they're just, we don't feed anything like that. There's no meal, so when they come into the parlor, they're just chewing the cud. One or two of them might have naps for themselves as they're being milked, and then we let them head off and it's all peaceful and beautiful up the fields. And then if you hung with us, it'd be all panic stations and just busy, 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 because we then go about bottling and then it's kind of into the van and off we go. So yeah, two pictures, cows nice and calm, us panic station.
Most importantly, what music do you play? what tunes do they like?
This is really debatable. We're trying loads of different things. They do like kind of 50s genre. They do like that kind of thing. I tried AC/DC and we had a dirty protest, so that won't happen again.
So as you've kind of implied, you've got a micro dairy on your farm. And I suppose I'm really interested for our listeners to find out how you use nature to add value to your product, most of all. And I know from, because you're an ambassador of ours, that you have meadow pastures. You might just explain how these kind of, the pastures, what they're like and how they've kind of added to your product.
We inherited the farm about a decade, just over a decade ago now. We did nothing with it for the first years because we kind of didn't really know what we wanted to do, to be honest. But when we were living in Dublin as well, so when we come down, I used to walk the fields with our dogs and things like that. And to be honest with you, they just felt like green fields. And 2015, my partner, Mick, he decided that he wanted to get some heifers. And I was writing a thesis on reducing meat and dairy consumption. So it was a fun kind of a few months of debate about it. But he insisted that, he said, it's just not as I remember it. It's, there's a thatch on the land, and he was talking about the fact that there was no life to it. And for me, I thought this place is stunning, you know. But he got the heifers, and he just brought in four originally, and then he brought in some more, and he just let them loose across the whole 17 acres to graze it back, because it had been left for about 3 or 4 years at this stage. I suppose we were actually kind of mob grazing them before what we knew mob grazing was. And then by the second year, when I went up the fields over the summer when I was down after my thesis, it was, this meadow had just popped up out of nowhere. I suppose I kind of wanted to understand what was going on. So I came across all the stuff at Sligo IT for the high nature value farming and things like that. And their website used to be able to kind of do a self score of kind of what score you would be out of high nature value. And when I did it, we were something like 7 point something or something. So I thought, okay, this is really good. How can we make this work? So from there, Mick never wanted to farm conventionally. He had farmed conventionally before. From day one, there was a couple of rules for him, and that was he didn't want to remove any hedgerows because of the 17 acres, they're broken into 10 different paddocks, and the biggest one of them is 3. And that 3 acres is our meadow field. So he didn't want to remove any hedgerows. He didn't want to remove any of the stone walls. He wanted to keep everything, I suppose, as a mark of respect to his uncle, as close to be as possible. And I suppose the intention was for him, he was probably just going to have a few suckler cows. And for me, I thought maybe we'll just use it as a tool to I suppose, as conservation grazing. You know, how could we graze it that would improve the biodiversity? Because we'd seen that one year had just brought this meadow back. Excuse me. So that's kind of how we started. And we started doing different things like mob grazing and not leaving them long on the ground. And when they go into the meadow field at the height of bloom, we would never let them eat a bear, so that when they eat through, there was still lots of kind of oxbow daisies and orchids left just for biodiversity. And then I started using the National Biodiversity app, and I kind of started my own, I suppose, little Excel sheets of what I was seeing each year. And then by the second year, I saw a dragonfly for the first time in my life. So I thought, okay, we're definitely doing something right. And of course, we're really getting into it and loving it, but 10 suckler cows and 2 humans, it's not very easy to make a living. Mm-hmm. So from there, that's kind of where we decided something like the micro dairy, because we had met more people over the years doing different things, would probably suit us at our scale. It was really the nature that got us there first, and then it was trying to figure out, was there a way that we could actually live on this land full time?
You never set out to kind of run a micro dairy. It just kind of fell into place like that. Yeah,
pretty much.
Can you remember a specific moment when you kind of realized that actually running a micro dairy over doing a suckler herd was a good thing for you and for your cattle or for the land?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a transition. The suckler cows we had originally just bought in, you know, heifers would have probably originally come from the dairy sector, so they would have come out of dairy cows, classic kind of Angus heifers. And some of them did well and some of them didn't. So we had to get, by our third year, we kind of got a little bit sharper. And we were like, okay, the cows that aren't doing well, so say those that routinely needed a dose, we removed them. Those that didn't really thrive without a grain, we took them out of it. So then we built this smaller but nice herd that could just thrive on the pasture-based system. Originally, MJ thought he wanted an Ayrshire because he remembered when they were kids, they'd milked an Ayrshire. And we ended up buying 2 Shorthorns, and one of them was a real, she was one of a kind. She was a real traditional Shorthorn, so small, close to the ground, but a great milker. And we started milking her for ourselves. And over that summer, we milked her for ourselves and she raised the calf. So we only brought her in every, say, weekend and things like that. But she did all of that on 100% pasture. So when we thought that, we kind of thought, okay, maybe there's a way to do this by and still keep our inputs at zero, because at this stage we didn't have, you know, there was no synthetic nitrogen coming into the ground, there was no grain, there was nothing. So we had to, even with the sucklers, we had gotten to a stage of zero inputs, but you could never really get the full value of what you were selling in that kind of way. When we started milking the Shorthorn, and I didn't really think about it at the time, I suppose it was just raw milk. And then I met Mimi Crawford, and through her and talking about different things, and they were really good to us. We went down for a day, and they're like our peers. They showed us kind of the ropes of what they were doing, and they have 1 acre more than us. So we thought, okay, if the guys can do this, maybe we can. Kind of go, maybe we can actually make this work as a living. Everyone keeps saying, are you making a living now? I'm like, talk to me in 5 years if we're still here. It's really hard to tell in the first 2 years of a business, but. Yeah, like we're obviously still here, and everything takes time to kind of build up. But it at our scale, it's the only way to be able to make a living from farming and achieve all we want to achieve with nature, and that's to basically have control of inputs and outputs.
So you have got to this, you're specifically working with traditional breeds, and you feel that's kind of been a better decision in terms of both the milk, but also in terms of nature responding to how the cattle are on the land?
Because I come across the Pasture for Life for a couple of years ago, I loved that idea and just thought, why do we need grain? I never really much, you know, we had a small succulent farm when I was a kid and I never really remember much of it. So when we had that Shorthorn and she just kind of fitted the system, we thought that was the breed to go with. So then we brought in a couple of Moyles and we tried that. But the Moyles over the, I suppose over the last 100 years is a dual purpose cow and a great cow, but it's a lot harder to find a really good milker. So even with the Shorthorns, it can be the same. So we're slowly building a herd who fit both once a day, 100% pasture based, and can produce milk off that. I suppose have a really species rich diet. You know, like we, our first year when one of them went, when a few of them went into the meadow field, their yield dropped. But then by the second year, that was not a problem. I suppose they get used to it as well, you know, particularly depending on what kind of system they've come from.
I was just going to say, do they target certain species or, you know, do you
They
find,
do, they
yeah.
have it. Yeah, like I have, it depends really. I have one video of one of our Shorthorns, and she was into the paddock and she literally just eats plantain. And she just walks through the whole thing and she's eating the plantain. And that's obviously self-medicating for her because it's supposed to be a natural anti-wormer for them. So that was just like when we see things like that, we kind of know, look, at the end of the day, they know what they need. And as long as we can give them as much access to diversity as possible, then they'll do what they need to do. So that's kind of all we do in regards to management.
It's interesting because plantain is one of the kind of super herbs for humans as well. So
Yeah, it's a
it'd be
brilliant
interesting
plant.
if it kind of, I don't know, comes through the milk, you
I'd
know.
say so. I read trials that were out of New Zealand where they had started to reintroduce it in rye fields. And what they found was it's a higher protein. It has a protein sometimes of about 17%. But it also reduced the levels of ammonia in the cow's urine. So it's a magical plant.
It works.
Absolute magical plant.
And you kind of find that the pastures are then responding to that. It's so the cattle, you're mob grazing them. So that means you're moving them on a regular basis, I assume. And when you've got that 3 acre field, have you divided it up or
Yeah,
how do you carry it out?
it's a little bit different with the dairy. With the when we had the few suckers, it was mob grazing was great, you know. With the dairies, it's a little bit different. Mostly because you need to move them every day, and you obviously you're milking them. So when they come out of the parlor, they like to go into a fresh pasture. So we wouldn't move them, say, twice a day, unless that was the height of summer and we'd a really good growth period in one area. Then I might split the paddock again. And get them in it. So we try and stick to particular rules instead of following anything too prescriptive. So we don't want them to, whatever's there, we only want them to eat about half of the leaf so that we're leaving, like, I suppose, a solar panel behind. We never want them to eat it close to the butt. And we also want to kind of lots of cow paths in the one area if we can. So that's the natural fertilizer every time they come off. And we our rotation is about anywhere from 32 to 34 days across the 17 acres. So that's we haven't routinely dosed an animal here in since 2016. So we kind of there are a few rules that we stick to. But yeah, the pasture responds different. Like our meadow fields, it's always a fine balance between making sure that we get enough grass in it for the cows, but that we don't knock back. That we don't add too much fertility. The meadow survives on low fertility, so we're always trying to kind of balance that out. So last year we grazed it early. We had a little less oxbow daisy. So then over the summer, when a lot of the flowers, wildflowers were coming up, we just grazed it lighter, moved them faster off it, so that we were leaving plenty behind, for pollinators and that. And then the year before, we grazed it later. So every year we just change the management on that field so that we're trying to constantly balance it between, you know, we obviously need to feed the cows, but we need to maintain that meadow as well. So that's kind of the balance between them. And then other fields, every year different things will come up. Not last year, we didn't have much fetch, but the year before we had absolutely loads of fetch out in the pasture. We have an Instagram page, so every year taking photos. So that's kind of
It's your
my
little
sign for
diary, your
security.
notebook,
I'm kind of going,
your
we didn't
survey.
get fetch this year.
Yes.
So
It's interesting in the 6-7 years that you've been doing this, though, how, I suppose, how nature's been responding to your kind of method of farming.
The main reason we do what we do. Like, I think for us, our values and goals started from the perspective of wanting the farm to be a particular way in regards to nature, maintaining it as it was historically, because MJ has such a connection to the land. And then for me, from the nature part, and for him as well, and it's kind of progressed into being able to make a living off it via the micro dairy. The first year we had calves, I thought, my God, like, I so much more enjoy working with the cows than I did working in my office in Dublin. So I get to work with them, and they're a beautiful animal to work with. And then I get to do that, and I'm discovering more about things in nature every day that I just didn't know myself, you know. And I grew up in the country, but you're even in that scenario, you can be disconnected from it.
And maybe someone from the outside looking in might say, you know, this is, it's quite labor intensive what you're doing. You know, you're milking cows, but then you're also taking your raw milk to market. But you sound like you kind of enjoy it, and at that it's manageable as well.
Again, our scale, and because we run just this 100% pasture, you know, no inputs, we go for, we're seasonal. So we kind of have committed ourselves that from March to November, we're 7 days a week. It is intensive in the sense that it's not very hard physical labor, but we always have to be there. We milk in the morning, the cows head back, we're bottling, we're delivering that out. And, you know, every year you get better. This year we're going to have on-farm collections, which will free up our time as well a little bit more, and things like that. And then we, towards kind of the end of the season, as grass begins to get slack itself, the cows naturally begin to pull back. So we let them dry off naturally kind of over that last month. And then when they dry off, that's it. It's right through until they begin to calf. And our first calves are due now, the first week of March. So hopefully no one will go early. So our December, January, February is totally off. And because we built a shed that was we have the most amazing, I suppose, natural features in our farm, but we had no kind of physical infrastructure. So we had to invest heavily and build a cow shed. We had to build a parlor. We had to build a process room, all those things ourselves. So that was kind of our big financial investment into it. So they go in there because we have 10 acres outside of the farm that we, when we had the sucklers, we used to cut for silage and graze. But with the dairies, it's harder to graze it. So at least now, being organic as well, we have farmyard manure. So we compost that down and add some biostimulants, things like that, and then put that out in spring. So, yeah.
So aside from the kind of the infrastructure, which obviously, as you say, comes at a cost, I assume overall it works for you financially, or you wouldn't still be doing it, or you wouldn't still be able to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously for us, there's a capital investment because we had no financial, or we had no infrastructure. Mm. So that's kind of our capital investment, but that's kind of like any business, you want to have some kind of investment into it. And then from there, our running costs throughout the year are quite minimal because, again, there's zero inputs in regards to the farms. There's no grain, there's no fertilizers, and a salt lick. Give them Himalayan salt.
So it's there for their form of chocolate, nearly kind of.
Yeah, pretty much. That's their
before they're about to pop.
That, and we have a small little orchard, and we have to kind of fight them for the apples in September and October, but. but that's really kind of the running cost of the farm, I suppose. After that, then it should be just, you know, a contractor to get your silage done or things like that. But far that, yeah, we tried to keep it really low because we knew when we were going down the micro dairy route that we were going to have that investment. And it's not cheap. Like, thankfully, we got it done before everything started going crazy this year. Mm. But we did a lot of it ourselves to keep costs down, but even at that, it wasn't, you know, we knew that to make it work, we had to have that full control, and the best way for us to have full control is just not to have those items. And if we can make it work without all those external things, then we can pull the full value of the external price for us as a wage, if that makes sense, rather than the cost of running the farm.
So what do you think is the biggest difference between the milk you produce and the milk a cow on a kind of a large scale dairy farm might produce, or, you know, or the differences between your cow and the milk she produces?
I suppose we always kind of started from the base. I suppose particularly with our kind of, you know, the people who buy off us, they know us, but they probably know the cows more. Like I often get a message now around February from someone who proceeds to tell me that their son or daughter reckons that Zoe's due to calf soon. And I'm like, oh, yeah. So we've always been very, very open with the farm because I grew up on a farm, had no interest in a farm. And then that first year when the cows calved in 2017, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Why did I forget that this was so good? And so I've always kind of wanted to be as open as possible. And MJ is the same, so that we can just be, a space for other people to connect with cows because they are amazing. So
do you do it live from the maternity ward or something?
I have, yeah. I have to put up a content warning, graphic content warning. They're so prepared for it now. But we do share things like that. You know, we don't hold back and we get, you know, awkward questions. Some people find awkward questions and we answer them as best we can. And, you know, we want to be as open as possible. So when people buy off us, they're buying because they know we're 100% pasture fed and they know what that means. They know that we're organic. They know that the cows run in species rich meadows. You know, we take photos of the bees that we have, the dragonflies, the birds, all of those things. So people are, when they're buying off us, they know they're supporting that type of farm and the way we farm, if that makes sense, rather than the milk itself. The milk is kind of like a product, a result of the things that we're trying to do on the farm. So that's kind of how, you know, when we ask people why did they buy off us, that's really their main reason.
How does that make you feel?
Yeah, good. Like, we won't lie, that's exactly what we want. You know, that was always it was why we started doing it. So if that's why we're doing it and that's why people are buying off us, then that's the goal achieved. I suppose it's just trying to maintain that. It's trying to make sure that we always maintain that balance between the living and being as, I hate the word sustainable because it can apply so many things, but I suppose being as good as possible to the land that we've inherited so that we do pass it on to the next generation better. And we got it in a great state, so we're under a bit of pressure. So we do different things, like, you know, we plant in as many trees as possible every year. Then I lose most of them to hares because we have so many hares. So we accept it that, you know, you'll have 50% loss. So we're just kind of constantly, I think the whole thing with life and whether you're concerned about biodiversity or climate change is trying to find a balance in between those things, you know.
Like you say, it's quite labor intensive thinking about, you know, nature does its own thing, but sometimes you have to plant things or build ponds or whatever. But can you remember one particular moment where you went, oh, this is all worth it?
So normally what happens is when someone comes, and particularly if they're coming in summer, and they walk up the meadow, and then they're just like, oh my God, I haven't seen a meadow since I was a kid, or I've never seen a meadow or something, you know, and things like, and then we're just kind of standing there going, yeah. You know, we're doing all right. Like, and it's always something like that.
What would you say are the biggest differences between you and a conventional dairy farm?
We're organic. We're the pasture base definitely brings an element, multiple elements then as well. And being pasture based means the milk is constantly changing throughout the year. Sometimes at the height of summer, a bottle can be half cream, which people love. It's never the same. It also brings in the seasonality part of it, which is great. You know, when people contact me this time of year and they're like, oh, 5 more weeks. I'm like, I know, we're getting there. You know, people are kind of are craving it, which is great because
milk addicts.
I think sometimes with food, we forget all that goes into food, and food is seasonal. You know, we just have a global food system that allows us to kind of remove a lot of those scenarios from it. So even being pasture-based and seasonal brings a level of connection for customers that they didn't think about before. You know, when we say it to them, you know, we're pasture based, so when growth stops, we stop. They're like, yeah, that makes sense. I get that now. You know, so they kind of see some of our customers prepared themselves well this year and they bought extra to freeze or to support it for themselves. Those things are, I think, is what really makes a difference is the fact, obviously you've got the practical things, the once a day, but there's lots of conventional guys converting to once a day as well, because For the farmer, it can free up the time, and for the cow, it's absolutely fantastic. You know, you're not pushing them. They're able to milk without being overly, I suppose, worked. So the longevity of our cows is a big thing.
And where can farmers get advice and support if they want to set up small scale dairy farming?
Their best bet is probably just to start talking to the small micro dairies that are out there. So there's ourselves, there's Crawford's, Ballymaloe were really good to us. They give us great advice as well. Talk to the kind of smaller scale dairies, see what they're doing. Knott's then is another great base. I think Knott's has got some interesting things happening this year on it as well. That's how we started. We just spoke to loads of different people, asked 1,000 different questions, and then we did multiple different plans of how what would work, what wouldn't work. And as I said, your context is going to be different. What are your goals? And for us, it was to be on the land 24/7, and you know, the micro dairy allows us to do that.
I mean, while it does seem a bit of work and you're wearing a lot of hats, it does sound like your cattle are thriving, you're producing great milk, your customers are happy, your land and nature that you're supporting is thriving. So ultimately, it sounds like to me, outside looking in, a lovely working environment for you and your partner. Sinead Moran, thanks a million.
Thank you.
If you liked this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to the Farming for Nature podcast series. If you'd like to contact me, email info@farmingfornature.ie.